Welcome to the Triple Top Line Podcast. This is the first podcast where you can learn how your business can create a positive impact on people, the planet, and profit. Here we bring the most brilliant minds from the startup and sustainability worlds to share their opinions and ideas around the topic. I'm Alex, co-founder at Catalyst Adventures, and I'll be here as the host on the show.
So an extremely warm welcome to Livia Kalosaka, here with me in the studio and online. Livia is an expert in deep tech for climate and leads an organization called Yes Europe. So this is young leaders in energy and sustainability. I think you got the link with the yes there. And Livia's working with young leaders who are obviously accelerating the change and the transition to renewable, green, future, sustainable energy. I'm not sure which one you'd choose from there. So Livia, very warm welcome, first of all.
Thank you so much, Alex, and thanks for having me here today. Very delighted to be a part of your podcast.
Super, thank you. It's a great pleasure to have you. So let's jump straight in and let's, you know, remind everyone why do we need to change our energy sources? What's wrong with fossil fuels? What's wrong with burning up the dinosaur juice? Why can't we stay on this trajectory?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's under the eyes of everybody. There is climate change is occurring, and a big portion of that is due to the CO2 emissions being due to anthropogenic sources. And so what we need to do is try to reduce our CO2 emissions. There's, of course, other type of molecules like methane that are playing a huge role into global warming. But I think we have a challenge as a generations in this century, and this is climate change. And so I think we need to move forces together to accelerate towards a more sustainable world.
Super. And what about the young leaders that you're working with? Are they do they feel this urgency? Is this something that they're burning to do, or is education a big part of what you're doing with them?
I think it's coming down to many aspects. One of them is, of course, in the last years, there's been a lot of noise going on around climate change. And so the younger generations are coming in with an education aspect as well that is more conscious about the effects of climate change. So that's one part of the game. On top of that, I think also that there is a inner change within people, that they want to have a more impactful life. And so that also plays around the aspect of many people trying to change their career trajectory, trying to have their own businesses, trying to work for startups or more, let's say these big corporations that are more oriented towards people and planet rather than profit. And so I think it's a bit of a mixture. But in Europe, I also think that we are kind of trying to lead the acceleration towards a more renewable system. And hence, I think a lot of young people in Europe, they feel that also this is something we're quite pioneers in the world and they want to be part of the game.
And then perhaps you could share a little bit about your story. You've got an impressive background. You hold a doctorate. What was it that started your journey with sustainability and what made you engage?
Yeah, I mean, this we could go on forever, but let's say that if I look at my past, I always, whatever I think of what I wanted to do as a child as well, had always been centered around trying to help people or animals, the world. And one of the main aspects that made me pivot towards sustainability was during my bachelor, I was studying chemistry. And of course, there is a so-called green chemistry, right? And green chemistry doesn't just mean green in terms of sustainable, but it was also in terms of the profit needs to be sustainable. And so I started, thinking about, all of these green chemistry aspects. And there I understood that green chemistry on its own would not save the world. Giving you a small example, I was working on biomass, so on solvents that could dissolve cellulose. So cellulose is, paper, wood, and trying to make biofuels out of it. But of course, when you look at it from a bigger picture, you realize that, using biomass, and this was some years ago, using biomass to produce biofuels is not probably the best choice because you're taking away resources, you know, land that could be used for, let's say, agriculture, right? And hence, you need to always put everything in the bigger picture. And that made, you know, basically I did a pivot towards environmental technology. So trying to look at the problem for a more holistic approach. And I came into, I basically got acquainted with the term of systems thinking. And during this systems thinking approach, this is really where you try and do all the connection and realize that like in a human being, you know, one plus one doesn't make two, but it can make more than that. And so that's the kind of approach mentally that I try to use in my everyday life and in my career. And having pivoted from that, I worked a bit in a large multinational to try and understand how supply chains were working, how big companies, you know, what was the business model behind it. So a bit more in the business acumen. And I went back to do a PhD. Here I am now working a bit in the VC ecosystem. So trying to scale up startups that have an impact on climate.
Thanks. I think that sense of, you know, looking at things holistically and then making those connections that it's a bigger systems thinking kind of problem. It is a complex adaptive system we're dealing with, and there's no kind of, you know, one golden bullet that's going to solve all of the problems here. And it also resonates with my own journey in the sense of perhaps starting out with volunteering and NGO work, non-for-profit work. You know, is that something else that you see among the leaders you're working with, that they have a background or some experience in the social sphere where they haven't necessarily been motivated by the profit motive? Or
yes, again, I think that the population, the young population these days, and I talk specifically about Europe. On one side, they're trying to have a job that basically lets them sustain a life. And on this, at the same time, not everybody's fulfilled by this job, right? And so they're looking for other experiences where they can think that they're actually having an impact. And this is where Yes Europe plays a role. We try and connect people and make them feel part of a wider community that is really interconnected throughout different countries in Europe. And when I mention Europe, it's not just the Europe as the European Union, but more the geographical area of Europe. And we try to make them feel part of something bigger and also to share their opinions about technologies, about policies, about laws. So it's really also, again, coming back to that systems thinking. So not just being technical people, but really bringing on a wide set of skills and of backgrounds into one place.
And then how did this, or maybe we could actually start off by defining deep tech for climate, you know, so. You know, for people who haven't heard that terminology before, what does it mean?
Yeah, so deep tech for climate, again, can mean many things. But basically, there is one fact that we need to consider is that there are technologies existing to solve climate change, or at least to combat it. But as well, we have a lot of solutions that don't exist. I think the number is around 50%. That's what people tend to say. 50% of the solutions we need do not exist. And these solutions are not just software. They're actually machinery that needs to be built. And hence, that's where deep tech comes. It's more on the hardware side and less on the software.
And if we try and convert that into, again, something that people might have heard of or understand, would an example of that hardware be something like the machines you've got in Iceland that are actually absorbing carbon from the air?
Exactly. This is one example of a deep tech startup.
Super. And could you share one or two more examples, please, from your amazing network as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I can show actually one that is coming out of Yes Europe, and it's actually the ex-president of Yes Europe. It's Dimitri. He co-founded a startup called Cultivated Bio. And basically what they try to do is to produce vegan cream. So, you know, moving on towards all these alternatives to dairy, they thought there was a gap into finding alternatives in terms of taste and texture to creams. So when we think about yogurt, when we think about cream that could be also, you know, whether ice cream or more things that you need to cook for, they found a sweet spot. They have their technology, which is based on a sort of biological process. And they're trying to, let's say, lead a small revolution in that field.
Excellent. So, Livia, you were talking about vegan dairy, and I was just thinking about, yeah, telling a colleague earlier today that we'd had Beyond Meat burgers last night for dinner. Everyone was blown away with them. It was absolutely delicious. And then a lot of the criticism in the press these days is around the level of processing in these subs foods. And so, what about with the vegan dairy? How do you balance that kind of criticism that is often launched at these solutions?
Well, I think that you can always criticize any sort of solution. There's always positive and negative aspects. I think as long as the positive outbalance the negative, it should be quite straightforward to adopt that solution. So I think that at the end of the day, it's not that hard to make a decision. Of course, I think there is a difference between alternative meats and alternative creams and all the post-processing, as you're mentioning, there needs to be more studies made about it. But we should also, you know, this is the approach of a scientist. At the end, you need to go with what you have in terms of knowledge. And if you have enough data that seems to point to the direction that the positives are quite good, then even though it might not be 100% good, we should go forward.
I would agree with you. I think that's also part of the work of being a pioneer and an innovator. You know, you're always going to have people, you know, telling you, oh, it's got to be perfect before you do this. And this is rarely the reality of what we work with when creating startups and creating solutions for humanity. And you touched a little bit already on some of the challenges of scaling startups. So we've just touched on that now with the criticisms that we often get. What would be the other sort of main challenges that you particularly see in the climate tech or the deep tech space?
In terms of scaling up?
Exactly. In terms of scaling up for startups, you know, what is specific to the deep tech space for them?
Yeah, I think on one side, it's the market. So a lot of technologies could exist in specific regions, but maybe they don't apply as well to others. And I guess that's also due to a bit of the investor side, that they always want to have this massive growth from the start. And maybe expanding too fast for certain technology is not the right approach. So they need to be quite wary with that. On the second challenge, I think it's also about the team. So especially when we look at, let's say, maybe less diverse or less international cities, the team that you will start building most likely is made by local people. And to embrace, kind of the scale up of a startup, you need to have that international mindset from the start. And hence, I think building the right team is always a challenge.
And what about the pipeline that's coming through from the universities? I mean, are we in Europe actually producing enough people with the competences that's needed for deep tech?
I think absolutely. There is a lot of talent in Europe. We have excellent universities. I think, that it's not specific to one country. Each country has its talent pool. And I think the only issue, and this is something that actually I'm doing also part of my work, is to connect the deep tech founders with the business side of things. So having a closer relation between business schools and, let's say, the so-called polytechnic schools, I think that's another challenge to embrace. And I think there's quite a lot of initiatives already taking place, so it's just about expanding those.
So again, sort of a more kind of systems thinking approach of these interrelations and interactions and cooperation between the different types of educational establishments and the political bodies and so on. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. It's really, you know, the technical founder might think that economics is easy science, and the economist might think that it's too complicated to understand chemistry. Well, actually, I think it's the communication can work. It's not smooth, it's not simple, but it can definitely happen, and we need to have more chances to make these different fields talking to each other.
I mean, that's definitely something we believe in at Catalyst Ventures, and having this, you know, cross-sector cooperation is definitely a key to building healthy ecosystems that can thrive with the support of one another. So it's lovely to hear you saying that this is a similar strategy that you're promoting there as well. And if we talk a bit more about Yes Europe, so your young leaders in energy and sustainability, We're big fans of Simon Sinek and his Golden Circle. Would you be able to talk us through your why, your how, and your what for the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. And stop me if I'm going too long, because I love it. So the why, I can go to the origin of Yes Group, and this is quite a few years before I joined the organization. They were founded at EPFL, which is it's very scientific focused university in Lausanne in Switzerland. And everything was born out of the fact that they were having debates around the topic of nuclear energy. And they figured out that nuclear energy had different public opinions, whether, you were speaking about it in a country like France, Switzerland, or, you know, Germany or Italy. And so what they were trying to do was to encourage discussions amongst students to understand the different perceptions around these technologies. And so everything started this way. So the why is really to make those connections, to make people feel basically be less afraid of new technologies and having a safe space where you can debate about them. And often, you know, and then we go on the how often these spaces are not easily built, and you can have them at work, but, you know, your reputations at work will always be there. So we created this platform at Yes Group where we connect people from different fields. So I want to encourage the fact that it's not just scientists. We have anthropologists, economists, lawyers, and you can ask any question and you will get honest feedback. And it's at the end, it's almost like a peer review committee. Let's put it like that, with not that academic burden. And then what we do in specific is that we have local teams. So we believe a lot on the fact that these communities should not just be present in major hubs in Europe, but we should really be a more distributed network of communities. And so we have country and country representatives, and we're present in quite a few countries in Europe, more than 15. And we try to coordinate them. And there is different ways we coordinate them. So this, let's say, it's more at the local level. And of course, then we have a lot of European level events where we try and get everybody together. Our flagship event is the annual conference, which this year, 2023, is going to happen in Athens in the end of April. And that's a chance for everybody to meet in person and also make those connections that are invaluable, that, you know, I'm sure that some of those will last throughout your life, whether as friends or as our professionals.
That's a lovely way to put it. I mean, starting off of that why of, you know, making people less afraid of technology, taking it all the way through to the connecting, the catalyzing, the coordinating, and giving people that opportunity to build friendships for life. It's beautifully explained. So thank you for sharing that. This is really cool. It reminds me, there's one, I think it's a Harvard Business Review article called "The Strength of Weak Ties." Have you read that?
No, I've not.
Maybe that should be my sharing one at the end. I'm going to ask you to share a book at the end, but that'll be my article. And it's a really cool article explaining how this sort of richness and diversity and depth of knowledge comes from having not just, you know, a couple of very good friends around you, but contact with a lot of different people. So it's exactly your kind of organization, like Yes Europe, which is facilitating these kind of connections. And it's sort of, you know, relatively weak ties. You don't see and speak to these people on a daily, even weekly basis, but you know they're out there and you can tap into those networks, and that gives incredible strength. So that's maybe something else to, it just popped into mind anyway from there. So Olivia, thanks for talking about it. It's been great to hear already about you, your background, your story, about your organization, you know, the why of the organization, but also your journey and why you've got engaged with climate change and solving these challenges. We've also already started to touch a little bit on the scaling the startups. Just something else before we talk more about youth, let's just go back to this sort of hardware scaling of hardware startups. So with our approach with Triple Top Line, you know, hardware startups are often the most difficult because you're producing often, you know, metal, plastic, you know, using rare earths and similar when coming up with these kind of solutions. And what we're looking for is how to support these organizations to transition to planet positive with their activities. So can you think of any examples where your organizations, your partner organizations, are coming up with hardware solutions, and those hardware solutions are actually circular, or they really have thought about the full life cycle of the tech itself in the tangible physical kind of hardware sense of the word.
Yeah, I think you're touching on a very complicated and delicate subject, because from the start, it's especially when you think of new technologies, it's hard to think what you can do at the end of it. You don't know how long those technologies will last, so there's not enough data on that. So I think it's just hard from the start. But having said that, I think that a lot of these, so-called biotech companies that therefore play with biology to have a product, I think those probably are better positioned than others. At the same time, there's quite a few technologies that rely on existing equipment. So I think that's not a bad, case to take either. So already using existing technologies that you can, reassemble in a different way and create new tech out of it. I know at least one of the startups I work with that are trying to leverage on that. But yeah, I would definitely, I would be a promoter, and that's also was a bit the topic of my PhD, to use biology as much as we can, to because they've evolved through so many, there as a species, a lot of species out there have been out there more than us as human beings, and so they have better efficiency, and I think we can leverage a lot of that. Just to mention, plants and photosynthesis, what we could do with that, and solar. There is an untapped potential in nature.
I would totally agree with you. I think that's a really nice way to put it. Untapped potential in nature to make the things that we're doing circular and much more sustainable in that sense. And if we then move on to the topic of youth, you obviously have an established network. You have teams, wide network of teams throughout Europe. What about the next generation? What about the next generation of young people? How do you engage with them, and how do you get them involved?
Love this question. No, because this is going to be funny. So I'll give you a very recent example. We were on Slack as a community, and to embrace more, and to connect to younger generation, we made the move to Discord. I'm not sure how many listeners of the podcast know Discord, but I honestly found there is a divide already between, more or less, I would say, is the people that are currently 23 and above don't really know about Discord unless they're gamers. Below, everybody knows about it. And so just to give you an idea, there we go. We moved towards Discord to really have this community also more widely accessible. And so anybody can jump on our server. It's public. Then, of course, we have, closed chats for more, delicate subjects. This is one way. Another thing we've been doing was last week, actually, I was in Lisbon at the European Youth Energy Forum. So that is, it was the first time in history, I can say, in Europe that such a forum took place. And it was really to gather the voices of young people from all over Europe, and again, Europe as a geography, and to basically put together position papers. So this is more on a policy level, and try and have an impact on basically having a wider proportion of youth having a voice into whether industry, education, or governments. And a lot of cool things came out of that week.
Sounds amazing. I mean, using Discord, using a channel, a communication channel that really they like to use, and I guess it's a theme of open information, of involving them in policy decisions, involving them in policy creation and suggestions. Extremely empowering on that side. I mean, what more could be done? I mean, it's almost the question, if you had unlimited resources, how would you go crazy and scale this even more?
If we could go crazy, I think at the end of the day, it's also a lot about having the right narrative. So I would focus a lot more on the narrative around energy, around youth, around climate change, and make it, it's going to sound funny, but, make it a bit more sexy. An understanding that at the end of the day, you know, the energy sector is not a sector alone. It's actually nowadays connected to everything else. And so we cannot talk anymore about the energy sector, and whether any business you'd like to work with will have to do something about their energy. And so I think we need to build a strong narrative around this topic. And hence, yeah.
I love it. I can't wait for your youth leaders to create this. I mean, for the last sort of 10, 15 years, it's been a struggle of getting sustainability away from this, you know, don't drive the car, don't print the paper, don't do this, don't do that. This constant sort of negative narrative of all the things you shouldn't be doing, and how to actually change that around and make that into a, you know, much more empowering and forward-looking, exciting narrative that can really engage people and get them on board, I guess.
Exactly. I think you got it right. Like, excite, you know, make this exciting and not dull and not depressing as well, right? I think there is this term eco-anxiety coming up, or at least it's been around for a bit. And yeah, it's totally, wouldn't say a positive name if we just think of the terms itself. And hence, yeah, what we do at Yes Group is always try and imagining a future that we would like to live in, and we work backwards from that. So not thinking of how bad it could be, but instead how cool it could be, and then how do we get there?
Yeah, I think you know, you've touched on a good one there with the eco anxiety of people, you know, not wanting to go and travel and visit loved ones and family because they're afraid of their carbon footprint, or people who are paralyzed with decision making because they don't know what to choose, they don't know what to eat, you know, because they're afraid of doing it wrong or being blamed or shamed with this. So I think this is another, you know, big part of the transition for us to turn this into a positive. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was actually one of the reasons as well. You know, a few of us had the chance to go to COP just a few weeks ago. And, you know, we're like, well, what should we do? Fly? How, you know, is there any other way you can get there? There was like, okay, can we at least, you know, try and compensate for our emissions of our flights? And so we sent a small delegation just with the, you know, with the people that could go. But it's definitely something in the, you know, in the mind of a lot of people every day. And yeah, it's a hard one to balance. But I think there's quite a few tools coming up also to try and at least make you become more aware of where your impact is. And I think that one of the simplest, at least things that I learned, is that just having a diet that is less meat intensive and traveling as little as you can by plane, probably, you know, plays a huge role. Or not having a car, right, by the way, is also that. There's two, three big actions that you can do that have a very large impact. And then the other ones are more, let's say, you know, there's smaller actions that don't have such an impact. So it's also about prioritizing them.
And we've heard recently about the change in Spain with students in Barcelona having mandatory classes now urgency of tackling climate change. Have you seen any other examples of where of education taking a key role or any sort of other public policy moves like that are really, you know, opening our eyes to both the challenges and the opportunities for solutions?
Yeah, I think the example of Barcelona is great, but also we need to think they have a culture in Barcelona of protesting a lot. I think the French are also around that. So it's culture as well. When they don't like something, they protest quite heavily about it. And this was a good example of how, you know, it ended up in a positive outcome. I think, you know, something that was actually listening to yesterday, it's a policy, and it's in Brazil. And basically what they did in Brazil is that every school basically needs to have in their canteen, I think the number is 30% of their food being produced by local farmers, so small producers. And by doing that, the country basically empowered a lot of small agricultures that otherwise couldn't compete with the industrial players to produce food. And they've seen enormous results in terms of nutrition for the children. So the nutritional aspect, which also improved their education because they could focus better. And then all the, you know, positive outcomes that come with that, and that will hopefully bring to a healthier and stronger generation.
Another great example, and you know, the first thing that comes to mind is that there will always be then people on the other side of the fence who are saying, "Oh, but you know, if we don't buy from other countries, we're not going to generate this interdependence. We're not going to lift them out of poverty by trading with them, and so on." But I think that really brings us back to your point at the start about this is complex systems thinking. This is not just, "Hey, let's just do one thing and one thing is going to solve everything." We literally need to engage every stakeholder at all levels. And drive them, and you know, the youth, I guess, for you are the solution. These are the next generations. These are the people who can actually solve problems for us.
Yeah. No, and I think you're right. And at the end of the day, also, I'm just as you're speaking, another great example came to my mind. This is in France. There is this association called Pour un Réveil Écologique, so it's for an ecological awakening. And what they're doing is they have a manifesto, and what they're trying to do is to have the best talents out of the best university in France, basically write a statement together that they don't want to work anymore for the big polluters. And so I think this forces, you know, companies as well to think about it. And if they want to survive and they need to retain and attract talent, they need to change a bit their business model, or at least the narrative around it. And so there's quite a few. Yeah, that's another great example of youth taking action.
Super. And I'm just thinking, you know, we're seeing the great resignation, that, you know, people are resigning en masse. We've got extremely tight labor markets. You've got sort of signs everywhere of people looking for work, for workers, for cafes, for bars, for restaurants. You know, is this really the generation where the youth are going to come out of schools and education and really have the power to shape the future of organizations by deciding what they want to be doing and what they don't want to be doing?
I think that initially that would be, you know, the first thought. As I came out of university, you know, the feeling I had was, you know, coming out of a kind of a group of like-minded people that wanted to do something good for the world. And honestly, what I'm seeing is that this thought or this attitude keeps going as long as you feel you're not alone. And I think this is also another thing we're trying to do at the ESUREP. It's not students, it's actually split basically half and half of young professionals and students, so that you don't feel alone in this, because otherwise it's easy to end up in a workplace. Maybe you end up also a bit isolated where you're the only one who cares. And you know, there's, you know, the older generation maybe is a bit more disillusioned about what you can do. Well, having a fresh eyes approach on companies, on businesses, can really drive positive change. So I think that as long as you don't change mindset and you're in an environment that keeps stimulating and keeps you positive about making a positive impact, then everything is set.
Yeah, I really like you're thinking of the power of the crowd there and getting that momentum, and yeah, not feeling alone. I think that's really important when you're tackling any kind of challenge that requires change. Okay, yeah. And let's jump in then to sort of the last section. So just going into the triple top line. So this sense of, you know, positive impact on people, planet, and profit. Is ESUREP a good triple top line example? And of course, if so, why or why not?
No, I don't know if it's the, you know, if ESUREP actually if it qualifies, because we're a non for profit, so there is the profit aspect doesn't play a role. But for sure, I would say it's a triple top line, because at the end of the day, what we do is to have a positive impact. So there is no business model, right? Which is the I think where I'm lucky to be part of an organization that I also think it's quite a bit of an experiment in terms of management. We use a so-called decentralized management approach, which is called Holacracy. Not sure if you're familiar.
But please share more. Please share more on how a Holacracy works. I mean, this is a good one for the audience as well.
Yeah, Holacracy is basically a different ways to manage your company by which you really empower your employees. And what that means is that instead of having a hierarchy, it's more of a, you need to think of circles. So it's a imagining of a wheel. So it's wheels moving together. And the way it works is that you have different wheels that represent different part of the organization. So for us at ESUREP, it would be communication, partnerships, the local teams. And what happens is that we have two types of meetings. We have the so-called strategy and operations and the governance meetings. And during this, you have a representative of each circle that will come and propose new ideas and whether perhaps we should establish a new circle. And that way the communication flow is quite direct, or at least that's the ideal outcome. And in the strategy and operations, it's more where everybody gets involved and everybody has the, you know, you share what's been going on in other teams. And it's more of a communication challenge at that point of having everybody on board during that meeting. But it's made to not having to wait for somebody at the top to say, yes, press the go button, and letting each person be the owner of their own decision. And as I said, it's a safe space. So what we always say is that there is nothing terrible that will happen if you take a, there's no bad and good decisions, but if you take one that perhaps wasn't the best one. And so I think people really appreciate that. And that's why we have so many volunteers, because at the end, it's volunteering based.
And what about then? I mean, we're saying, okay, it doesn't strictly fit being a non-profit organization. How do you ensure that your operations are then financially sustainable into the future? How can you approach that?
You mean operations?
Yeah, I mean, you know, any costs that you might incur. I mean, is that purely donation or grant based? You know, looking forward to the future, can you maintain it at that level? Can you have that bigger impact? You know, what's the thinking there in terms of the sustainability of the financial health of the company, of the organization?
Yeah, it depends where we want to go, right? So at the moment, we can survive without having any income. Mm-hmm. Let's put it like that. There is no strong operational cost apart from, you know, a few subscriptions to tools. But we have donors. So there is donors around Europe that donate a bit of money to us. And it can be simply because of HR. Let's say, you know, perhaps we give them access to talent. So it's very easy like that. But of course, we have bigger events. So probably it's more on an ad hoc basis. Let's say for our annual conference, we need to rent venues. And at that point, we look for strategic partnerships, which, you know, on one side for them, it's a nice visibility because they will basically get, last year it was 200 people coming from all over Europe to Torino in Italy. And it's easily marketable on their side, on top of which they can actually showcase their technologies. In that case for us was Stellantis, which is a big car manufacturer that was helping us with the venue. And it can also be startups trying to deploy their products, and hence they use as a bit of their, you know, beta testing. So there's different ways we can go about it. But there is a lot of potential there as well. We're even thinking of building a sort of a consortium, which basically means giving our knowledge on certain topics and being the voice of youth for certain companies that probably don't have easily access to that. But, you know, you're basically touching on what we were saying before, that on the circle, you know, we didn't have a circle on finance, and this is something we've established in September. So people, especially looking at how we can become more sustainable from our finance perspective.
So, I mean, I think it sounds like you're having an amazing impact in general. And as you said, it's, you know, where do you go, and what's the future, and can you scale this up and have an even bigger one with what you're doing? So obviously wish you all the best with that. And if we just come back then to sort of wrap up with a question around sort of deep tech science and the startup world. Is it really possible that a scientific discovery or a crazy idea can always be translated into a startup? Or is this wishful thinking?
I think you can, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if I can mention any big brands there, but I'm pretty sure we can all think of some big brands that they created a need for something that probably we didn't need or didn't exist. And so there is, of course, a bit of a pull factor. So something that needs to happen because we need that technology, but you can also create the desire for something. Then whether this is good or bad for, you know, the planet, the people, that's to decide. But absolutely, I think you can turn any technology into a startup.
Cool. I like the optimistic note to finish on. And then we have a bit of a tradition on the podcast that we always ask our guests, you know, to recommend one book for the audience. People are always asking around, what books should we read? What do you recommend? So what would be your book that you would give as a gift to someone?
Yeah, I think surfing the wave of optimism, I would probably recommend a book called Factfulness, which I'm not sure if you're aware of, but basically tells us, you know, how actually things are moving for the best and not for the worst. So always think
positive. Yeah, totally love the book. It's a great sort of party game as well with friends, especially people who at dinner parties think they know everything. It's really good to often knock them out with a couple of these with his facts. So great book to recommend, and lovely finish on the optimism as well there. So Livia Kalosaka, thank you very much for spending the time with us today. It's been a pleasure to hear. It's been inspiring to hear about what you're doing with your organization, with your networks, with the optimistic future for deep tech and climate tech, and how it can solve many of the world's great problems. I hope you've enjoyed the time today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alex, and all the Catalista team for the opportunity. And yeah, hopefully let's build, you know, a brighter future together.
Lovely note to finish on. Many thanks.
The future is triple top line.